Hi, I'm Chris Bailey, and I'm about to have a productive conversation with the one, the only Mike Vardy.
Welcome to A Productive Conversation. I'm Mike Vardy, and I am joined once again by my friend Chris Bailey. He is a good friend of mine. We chat more often privately than we do publicly. This is an example of that. Now, this episode, like the one previous, was recorded as a live stream for members of Time Crafting Trust Premium. We'll put a link in the show notes for you to get information on that membership program as well. We'd love to have you. During this episode, we talk about Chris's upcoming book, which is now out because we recorded this before the book came out. It's called How to Calm Your Mind. We talk about the idea of calm, chaos, order, the word that we don't think about so much when it comes to the present, the past, and the future, and so much more. It's a real candid and rather comfortable conversation, reminiscent of the first one I had with him at Zach's Diner back in Ottawa, Canada, so many years ago. It's always fun to have a Canadian on the podcast, and it's back-to-back Canada Week, Canada Weeks, rather, for... And it's back-to-back Canada Weeks because Marie's Canadian as well. So there you have it. If you missed that episode, by the way, make sure you check the archives. We'll get to that after this conversation, though. Here it is, my conversation with Chris Bailey. Enjoy. There we go. We get a little tease intro that we've never quite had before. It's funny, as we're recording this for our Time Crafting Trust premium members who have early access to the podcast, one of our members is saying that I just alluded to the fact that I've never had a chance to meet Joe in person before. We'll get together one day. It's great to get together with Chris here again. This is your, I believe, third appearance on the program with with the Productivity Project being the first time, then Hyper Focus being the second time. Now we are talking about how to calm your mind. And if you're a Time Crafting Trust premium member, Chris already showcased the beautiful cover and the physical aspect of the book, it looks great. It looks absolutely great.
It's still so fresh in my mind because these physical copies of the book arrived yesterday as we record this. And for some reason, and I think it's because of the journey that led to this but it feels like more than that to me. Mm-hmm. I just feel it's just more significant in my own life. Like when I look at the lessons that are inside of this one, and not to bash the other books, that's right. Not my intention at all. Because those were the journeys that I went through at the time in terms of focusing more deeply, becoming more productive. This kind of looks at productivity in a different way, in a deeper way, where we go into the structure of our life and our work and really dissect what productivity means, how we can get there, how we can become more focused and engaged. Man, I feel like a walking, talking promotional thing for the book at this point, but I'm just pumped.
What's interesting is you talk about the journey, and it is fascinating when I mention, the idea of the Productivity Project, which we met before we met when that book was just, barely an idea that was coming along. And then it goes to hyperfocus, which is a channeling of that focus so that you can be more productive and recognizing the different types of focus and how to leverage it. But now we're into this level of calm and tranquility to a degree, and even contentedness. And I'm wondering, for those that have followed your work before to this point, they're like, where does it, in the oeuvre, where is it? How did you get here?
Yeah.
And why did you go here for this particular book?
Yeah, this was a tougher journey than the others. In terms of hyperfocus, it was a process of becoming distracted, figuring out the research and how I could overcome that. The Productivity Project, when we were having lunch at Zach's Diner in lovely, it's rainy today here in Ottawa. That was before those days even. That was kind of a year-long experiment to go through all the productivity advice out there, separate what works from what doesn't. This new project on calm is not really, I've never really found it an attractive endpoint.
Right.
It's not a sexy productivity hack. And so I've never really been drawn to it. But unfortunately, there's a period a few years ago where I fell deep into calm's opposite, which is anxiety. Anxiety is the opposite of calm. They actually exist on a spectrum with one another, the research shows. And I found that I was at this point where I had these uncontrollable thoughts. I was just reactive on autopilot mode to what was happening around me. I was restless. I was on edge a lot of the time. And I didn't really realize it until this phenomenon of anxiety in my life erupted into a full-blown panic attack on stage in front of about 100 people. And I remember at the time just being on stage in this fight, flight, or freeze mode, just half wanting to, you know, run off the stage. And like, kind of like one of those shows where somebody just kind of walks into the ocean and then you see them disappear. That's what I wanted to do in the moment. But I remember the distinct feeling after this talk, thinking, oh my gosh, something needs to change here. I didn't really realize I was anxious at the time until it boiled over. I didn't realize I was burnt out at the time without it boiling over. I was exhausted, cynical, unproductive, and just totally depleted. I think, and this is not, again, to put down the advice that I was giving before this. I think we actually need productivity now more than ever before, because we need to be able to live and work deliberately in the circumstances that we found ourselves in. But at the same time, when we don't replenish and build up our capacity for being productive in the first place, that's when we get to a point of burnout. That's when we get to a point of anxiety. That's when we get to a point of not being able to manage ourselves. And that's where I found myself. And so I'm fortunate. I'm grateful, actually, for the journey that this panic attack set me on, even though it was uncomfortable and awkward at the time. It's now led to a lot of lessons learned that I hope other people can benefit from.
I wonder, as I was going through the book, and you know, we've had chances to converse outside of this, is this idea of we live in a world, especially I would say the Western world, about achievement. Achievement's a big deal. Mm-hmm. And I know that I was actually had a social media exchange with a friend of mine who was asking about meditation. And he said, how do I know when I'm doing it right? Like, how do I, it wasn't like he was saying, how do I win or achieve? Like, how can I check it off? And I think that's one of the challenges with calm, I would imagine, right? Is that, I mean, the other work that you've dove into before this, there is this level of, I can check this off. I can achieve this. I can accomplish this.
Yeah.
But there is no, to me at least, and I'd love to hear when you're, especially with the research, because you do a lot of research, like you dig deep into this stuff, this idea of achieving or accomplishing calm. There's almost like this, they seem to be disparate ideas, or this idea like you can't accomplish calm, or I'm going to win the battle against, you know, the battle for calm. Like, how do you correlate that? And how do you help someone who is so driven by achievement and accomplishment to recognize that calm is not only something that they need, but it's not something that they can necessarily check off on a to-do list?
Yeah. It's more of an arrival, you know, it should be our natural state. And so if you're just sitting there, you know, not really tending to any conversation, you should feel calm, right? You should feel as though there isn't anything to worry about. There's no impending doom. You should be able to find the presence and the peace of mind to engage with whatever happens to be in front of you and whomever happens to be in front of you. And I think the key here is to realize that calm is on the same spectrum as anxiety. And this is what one of the remarkable things about exploring the subtler things that make this profound effect on our productivity, calm being one of them. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to realize the extent to which calm can help us with our productivity, we just have to look at its opposite with anxiety. You know, if I asked you, you know, Mike, let's say you're doing a talk in front of a couple thousand people, and 15 minutes before you go on stage, I ask you to read something that I wrote or some journal article. There's no way in hell you're going to be able to read this thing, because your mind will be in that anxious state. And anxiety has this exact same effect on our mind, on our cognitive capacity, all day, every day. The closer we are to that anxious side of the calm spectrum, we're a fish in water, right? We don't realize that our mental state is what it is because we're so immersed inside of it. Our thoughts and our thought patterns are nested within this structure of anxiety. But when they're nested within a structure of calm, that's when we're on vacation. That's when we're, you know, a one weekend on a Dominican beach, just kind of putting our feet up. And we have that deliberateness on the side of calm. We have that capacity for focus on whatever it is in front of us. We don't need productivity advice, you know, if we can bring a capacity of presence with whatever and whomever we're with. And I think that's the key here is calm gives us this capacity for focus on whatever it is that we're doing in the moment. And it shouldn't be an endpoint. It should be our always point. It should be our natural state that lies underneath everything we do and everything that we are. We should be unflappable. And luckily, there are these concrete strategies we can invest in order to get ourselves there.
And that leads us to a really great question from a member of the Time Crafting Trust Premium community right out of the gate. Oh, so how did you transition from your panic state to calm? There's got to be one of those. What was the first strategy maybe that you tapped into that you feel maybe, was it a series of them or is there one in particular that kind of helped you?
Well, honestly, at the start of this journey, and I hate that I have to give this answer, but I had no clue what to do. I really, really didn't know because I was turning to a lot of the advice out there on burnout, on anxiety, and I truly found that it wasn't helping me. I was meditating. I was going to the spa with my wife, Arden. I was ordering copious amounts of takeout on the road in order to treat myself. And I still found that this anxiety had the space to erupt. And that was one of the most remarkable things, I think, about this journey that I went down. There's a lot of good advice out there. But this goes back to the productivity project that we were chatting about a bit earlier. You know, the ratio of good to bad productivity advice, most of it, maybe 60 to 70% of it is good, I would say. Mm-hmm. It makes us back time. And it doesn't always, but sometimes we feel more in control, our head is clearer, that sort of thing. With anxiety, the ratio is kind of flipped, where there is so much fluff out there, where when you look at the actual scientific literature on these ideas, they don't map on top of what is being talked about in articles.
Right.
You know, 8 ways to find calm this holiday season and you know, that sort of thing.
Right.
And make your 2023 the calmest year yet. You don't see many journal articles referenced at the bottom of these. So that was the first place that I turned to is what is the actual academic literature on calm? And the fascinating thing that I found was there isn't much of it. There is actually very little research. There's a lot on anxiety.
Right.
But the connection that I've made in the book is we have to see calm as anxiety's opposite. And there have been a few studies that found that anxiety is not a spectrum that goes from highly anxious to no anxiety. We can go past the point of no anxiety, which kind of resides in the middle of the spectrum, all the way down to a state of high calmness where we become less reactive and our mind is less agitated. Those are kind of the two factors that determine where we are. We relate to our thoughts in a more positive fashion as well. So I don't know if this answers the question, but there isn't a lot of research on calm. That was the fascinating thing is I had to dig quite deep in order to find it. But luckily we can accomplish much of what we're setting out to do by looking at this concept of anxiety and working our way down that spectrum.
I wonder if for you, knowing you the way I do, that digging in and looking was a form of leaning therapy into calm. Yeah. You know what I mean? I imagine, and I'd love to hear some thoughts on this, is this idea that there's not a lot, like you said, there's not a lot of research around calm. Mm-hmm. It's such a qualitative thing that it seems hard to quantify, right? Whereas other areas, And I'm not saying anxiety is like this, but other areas of productivity per se is very quantifiable. In fact, you are, you know, you discussed like the idea of productivity advice, you know, 70%, 30%. I would almost wonder if we looked at what productivity advice is gearing towards quantitative productivity versus qualitative productivity. I wonder what that ratio would look like, because to me, the, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on this, is the idea of the level, the relative ability for you to either maintain or find calm will have a direct correlation with to the quality of what you're able to produce. And the skews, I would imagine, the more anxious you get, and you talk about this in the book about the idea of the mindset of more, you tend to lean more towards anxious. So more leads to more anxiety, not more calm, right?
Yeah. And this is what researchers call an acquisition mentality. And so when we're always wanting more of what we have, we can never truly savor what we're doing in the moment. And savoring, you know, in addition to that acquisition mentality, was another fascinating topic that I had the opportunity to explore. And that's the lovely thing about, you know, writing a book is you can kind of go where you want and follow the most helpful threads in whatever research you're coming across. Savoring is actually a science. And so savoring is the process of converting positive experiences into positive emotions. And so, you know, I'm drinking a delicious cup of jasmine tea here in my CBC mug as folks in the time crafting, what's it called? Time crafting,
Trust Premium, which we'll have a link to the membership in the show notes.
There it is. Yeah. Link in the show notes, friends. You know, I'm drinking this cup of jasmine tea, but just because I'm drinking it doesn't mean that I'll enjoy it. You know, we all have these delicious meals that we scarf down distractedly in front of a TV or, you know, in a restaurant with somebody we can't stand. And so we're really not enjoying things. And then we have the wonderful experiences that we actually pay attention to, where we convert those positive experiences into positive emotions. And the fascinating thing about savoring is the wealthier somebody is, the less of a capacity they have to actually savor their lives. And men actually have less of an ability to savor their lives than women do. I'm not sure why that's the case, but with wealth, it's because when we, the more we acquire, the more we wish to acquire. And it's more that drives us forward instead of a goal. You know, goal, wanting more without an endpoint in mind, any goal without an endpoint in mind is really just a fantasy, right? We have to have that. Again, this is connecting the qualitative with the quantitative. We need to have that endpoint in mind when we're seeking more of something, because there are an infinite number of currencies in our life. There's, of course, money. There's, of course, status. There's, of course, these forms of currencies that are more traditionally valued in cultures like the ones we're inside of. You know, if you have more followers than somebody else, you're seen as more impressive than somebody else. But there are other currencies too. What about happiness? You know, it's something that we forget about. And I think happiness is what drives a lot of us to acquire more of what we have. But I think, you know, when we look at that value that the modern world has, you know, the last place we should be looking for happiness advice is the modern world. The modern world is not happy. The modern world is not present. The modern world cannot savor what it has. We walk past, we blow past the most beautiful experiences of our life without so much as even paying attention to them, let alone enjoying and deeply savoring them. And this is actually connected with dopamine, you know, the neurochemical that, you know, is one where I think we have to take a shot for every time it's mentioned almost, because so many people are talking about it. That's actually a less understood idea as well when you look at the actual research. But it's interesting that when you look at the neurochemical underpinnings of our acquisition mentality, when you look at the neurochemical underpinnings of our constant craving for more, it's dopamine. It's dopamine that drives us forward. Dopamine even has the nickname, the molecule of more, by some researchers into this topic, because it drives so much of that. But when you look at the chemicals that are active in our mind when we're actually enjoying an experience, which is, by the way, what life is all about, right? It's savoring a conversation. It's enjoying a meal at Zach's Diner in Ottawa. It's enjoying a cup of delicious jasmine tea. That's happiness, right? It's in savoring. When you look at the chemicals that are active in that mode, it's serotonin, which makes us feel proud. It's oxytocin, which makes us feel connected. It's endorphins that gives us this rush to do something. Those are anti-correlated with dopamine as well.
It's interesting because, you know, as you're talking about this, I'm thinking about my coffee ritual in the morning, right? Yeah. Like, I'm not a morning person. Yeah. I'm a night owl. And anyone who's been following my work for a while definitely knows this, but
we all know this.
Mike. Yes. Yeah. We all know this by now. So it's not new, but it's funny because my wife and I have two very different relationships to coffee. I'll use that as a, cause it's also subjective too. Like, I think that's the other big thing too, is what's good for the goose isn't good for the gander necessarily. So we have two separate coffee areas in our house. My wife has hers upstairs, which is like literally Costco beans ground up, blah, blah. Coffee for her is more or less a caffeine delivery device. Like, there's no real savoring of the making of the coffee. However, she will make a cup of coffee so she can have it while she's reading, which she is safe. So there's a companion element to it. Now, for me, I will literally spend 4 to 5 minutes making a cup of coffee using different implementations. And to me, like, there is, which I didn't realize as you're talking about, I'm like, this is what probably one of the reasons why I'm able to, despite the fact that I'm a night owl, start my day in more of a calm state.
Yeah.
Because I'm literally fueling it with that ritual that promotes calm. So, I wonder.
And calm mornings do lead to deliberate days.
Yeah.
And, you know, the fascinating thing about what you just mentioned, this brings something to mind. There are actually, we can savor the past and the future. That was one of the most remarkable things that, you know, I had the chance to encounter. There are a lot of ways of savoring the present. We can luxuriate in the present. You know, think of a cat in the sun. Practice Thanksgiving. We can feel grateful for things. We can marvel at something. We can marvel at the ocean, the sky, the beautiful forest or some nature. But we can actually savor the future as well. It counts as savoring because we do it in the present. And that's called, we've all done it, anticipation. Mm. And so when we count down the days to an event, for an example, we actually have been shown to enjoy an event more when it does happen. When we count down the days, because this act of anticipation, researchers, they describe it as creating effective memory traces in our mind, kind of paths that are faded in our mind that we can walk down once again when we experience something. And after anticipating something, our mind perceives it as though we're experiencing that thing for a second time, which I find to be absolutely fascinating. So when you have that ritual around coffee, when you have that ritual around, you know, making your matcha green tea in the morning or walking to a coffee shop across town, that actually leads you to enjoy something more. Savoring the past is another thing that I love to do. And you know the name for that?
Reminiscence.
Yes. Got it. Yeah. Good work. 10 podcast points for you. So looking through old photos is a great example of this.
I read my journal every New Year's Day, January 1st. I read the entire journal, that whatever journal entries I did over last year.
Yeah.
And it's phenomenal. There's this quote from Jessamine West who said, those who journal get to live life twice.
Oh, I love that. It's so true.
It is.
Because of reminiscence.
Yep.
And we enjoy, our life becomes more meaningful when we reminisce on it. And so savoring, you know, makes us more calm, but it also makes us more deliberate. and we enjoy experiences more. It's one of my favorite things. And one tactical thing people can do, make a saver list if you find this to be a challenge. And if you're driven a lot by this acquisition mentality, if you have a lot of dopamine-driven behavior, like engaging with a lot of digital distraction, this might be more of a challenge or a chore than it is something that produces satisfaction. But that's exactly the point of doing it, is we can, savoring is actually a skill we can get better at. But make a list of everything that you love to savor or that you used to savor before your mind was more distracted and overwhelmed and maybe even more anxious. You know, everything from the tea to the coffee to the wine-fueled cribbage nights with your wife, you know, whatever it might be. Capture it all. Pick one thing every day and enjoy it. It's great.
What I love about savoring too is it is almost, it's permissiveness to be present and yet savor things that live outside of the present moment. So you are present, but you're looking at, like you said, the past and the future. And what I also like about it is no one says savor the minute, they say savor the moment. Like, so moments are, no one, like you saying make a list and stuff like that adds a quantitative element to a degree. Like there's 14 things or whatever, and that's fine. But you don't, it's moments, right? And moments are, it's weird because a lot of people will say, and I know in Chip and Dan Heath's book, The Power of Moments, I don't think they ever really define like, this is how long a moment is because it's so subjective. And so, and we're going to get to a question here in a second from Edward in the community, but the idea of in your research, was there an objective definition or was there a way for people to quote, know that they are living in calm or in that, that state? Because we all know that humans need both certainty and uncertainty. There's that balance there, but there's a comfort in feeling a certain way or being in a certain way so that you can grow from that point and to have that validation. So did you find anything like that, or is it, or are there ways to maybe try to not manipulate, but lean into it a little bit more?
It changes so much that I think it's impossible to measure overall. You know, when you look at anxiety, calm's opposite. We have state anxiety and trait anxiety. So trait anxiety is what produces anxiety disorders, you know, that sort of thing. It's not something I focus a lot in the book on,
right?
Because I'm not a psychotherapist. But it's that state anxiety that is brought on by the events of our life that it's impossible to avoid.
Right.
Right. We all have stressful moments in our life. And if you went back through time and removed every single stressful moment from your life, you would eliminate pretty much all of the meaning from your life as well. Your wedding is probably stressful.
Yep.
Also probably incredibly enjoyable, hopefully.
Well, and you remember the enjoyable parts more than, say, the stressful parts in those moments. Whereas in other situations, you remember the stress more than the not stress, right? And there's use stress and regular, like, so there's, and you can't identify what those are necessarily at that point in time either.
Yeah, and there's a great quote from Sonia Libomirsky where she has said that vacations are never perfect, but we remember them as perfect. It's this rose-colored glasses effect. And we need the meaning that stress provides. We don't want to remove our weddings and our vacations and our, births of welcoming kids into our life and, you know, that sort of thing. So we need a bit of anxiety, I would even say, because we need stress. It's that distinction that you made, that dichotomy between eustress and distress, where eustress is this stress that makes us grow. And another kind of distinction that I think is worth making is between acute stress and chronic stress. And so chronic stress is, it's the bad kind, right? If acute stress is the once-off traffic jam on the way to the airport, chronic stress is the constant traffic we experience every damn day on our way to work.
Right.
It's the irreconcilable feelings we have when we just look at some, it's the stress we experience when we look at our bank account and just get frustrated every time. Chronic stress is what causes burnout. And that was an important connection that I personally made in this journey, is understanding what burnout really is.
Yeah, 'cause you didn't know you were burnt out, did you?
I had no idea. And it wasn't until I took the Maslach burnout inventory. Christina Maslach is probably the world's foremost researcher on the subject of burnout. I had the chance to chat with her a few times over the course of writing the book and read every single journal article that she's ever written as well to connect those and filter them through my own perspective. And one misconception that I had was what burnout even is. We think of exhaustion as burnout, just when we're totally depleted. But looking at the research, exhaustion only is a third of what it means to be burnt out. There are two other factors that we must have in order to be burnt out at the same time. We need exhaustion, right? That feeling of just being totally depleted. But we also need to be cynical. You know, this negativity that we have, regardless of whatever it is that we're doing. And we also need to feel deeply, profoundly unproductive. This sense of inefficacy is a third attribute of burnout. And the research shows that the more chronic stress we have in our work and our life, mostly our work, burnout has been traditionally defined as a workplace phenomenon, though, of course, it's impossible to distinguish between these environments as time goes on. Mm-hmm. It's fascinating. There are six areas of our work that contribute to this phenomenon of burnout, but it's the chronic stress that comes from it all that contributes to this exhaustion, cynicism, and feeling unproductive. So those three factors are a great sign to look at these six areas, but it comes back to chronic stress, this stress that often we choose to pay attention to ourselves. Not realizing that we're engaging with stress in the first place sometimes.
As we get close to wrapping up, I want to make sure that I address the questions that are coming from the premium members of our community. Edward asks, if anxiety is to chaos as calm is to focus, where are we most productive and why? That's an interesting question.
If anxiety is to chaos as calm is to focus.
Now that's a big, that's the first part. I think there's two questions there. Is that true? Did you find that to be true? I'll tell you that, like, it's interesting because you guys know that are watching this live that are members, and Chris, you know this because I talk about the Marvel Cinematic Universe all the time.
Yes.
Vision said, there's this quote where he says, humans are odd. They think that chaos and order are different things, but they're not. And then the idea of balance is Dr. Fate's another example where people say, he works for the Lords of Order. And he goes, no, he works for balance. He doesn't work for order. Because without chaos, you can't have order. And without order, you can't. Like, they're almost two sides of the same coin. So my question, I guess that's an adjunct.
Yeah.
Is anxiety the chaos and is calm to focus? Are they like, and then if that's the case, where are we most productive and why?
Well, I think calm gives us a capacity for chaos. So that would be the connection that I would make.
Okay.
Is calm is the ground that we should be standing on, where regardless of what our situation actually is, we feel as though we're engaged with it and that we don't have anything to worry about. So, you know, I look at calm in this book from that mental state where how many thoughts are tugging at our attention in the moment that are, you know, there's task related thoughts, which are about the thing we're engaging with, and task unrelated thoughts that are, oh, wait, I should worry about this, or I should remember this cringeworthy thing I said 8 years ago. I think calm gives us a capacity for chaos. And ultimately, with a calm mind, it doesn't really matter if things are chaotic or if things are order and they have a place, you know, it's like the clouds in the sky. You know, I start and I want to get it right. I start the book off with a quote, and that quote from Pema Chodron is, "You are the sky. Everything else, it's just the weather." And I think this quote encapsulates what this kind of calm means, where things happen, you know, things that are stressful happen, shit happens. Mm-hmm. It's what we need, the mental capacity to deal with it all and not be bothered by it. And that's what calm gives us.
Chris, there's a lot that we weren't able to cover during our conversation today. And that could be said for when we've chatted about hyperfocus and the productivity problem. The depth and breadth even, but more so depth that you go into with this book and any of the work you've done, like it's something you need to dive into. I mean, you talk about analog, you talk about stimulation fasting. Mm-hmm. And I strongly encourage people to pick up this book. But the last question I have for you, and this is related to a story that I said when I accidentally misquoted the title of your book during a conversation we had, and you were quick to correct me. And so I said, "Chris, your next book is called How to Be Calm." You go, no, "How to Calm Your Mind." So it brought me immediately to the thought of the advice that you get where you should never say to somebody, "Calm down," because it's like literally the opposite thing the opposite will happen.
Oh, I didn't think of that. Thanks for the suggestion.
So when I said how to be calm and you were quick to correct me, I know it's probably the title of the book was, but that's not something that is just so, I guess the point is it's not easily done, and you can't just, quote, be calm. The idea of the mind being calm is what you're getting at, correct?
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. And we deserve a calm mind. You know, it's not that it's a nice thing to have. We need a calm mind to deal with the world right now. You know, there's so much changing. There's so many threats that we're constantly exposed to. There's the chronic stress that we choose to pay attention to. There's news, there's social media, and all this creates a confluence that leads to overwhelm. And we feel like we are not in the driver's seat of our own lives. Or at least this is how I felt at the beginning of the journey. Again, it's a spectrum everybody exists at a different place on. But you deserve a calm mind, right? You deserve the fortitude to deal with whatever comes your way. You know, you deserve to have solid ground that you're standing on, and you deserve to have a capacity for accomplishing the things that you set out to do. You know, you deserve to have the ability to accomplish more of whatever currencies you set out to savor your life. And I think that's, you know, why focusing on the mind is such a powerful thing. You know, if somebody says, "Hey, yeah, calm down," that's not advice we can take. But when you look at the actual, there is actual science for overcoming an anxious mind and moving towards the calm side of that spectrum. And by acting in accordance with it, we actually bring these ideas down to the surface layer of our life, to the not the minute, the moment, and can actually make progress towards this ideal ground to stand on. So I think the mind is the key here.
The key also is to pick up the book, How to Calm Your Mind, Finding Presence and Productivity in Anxious Times. Chris, where can people pick up the book, and where can they keep up with you and your work?
Yes, sir. Well, thank you for having me on the pod once more. Third time, hopefully, is the charm. Well, we're going to have to do one of these when I don't have something to promote. Yeah. So we can just hang out.
It feels
out.
Like it's a late night talk show every time we get together. This latest book is...
Yes. out of anything I've ever written and anything I've ever created, I am most proud of this book. And I don't say that to sell you on it. This journey has helped me immensely. It's changed my life legitimately. And so I hope you'll consider picking up a copy. How to Calm Your Mind, wherever books are sold. I read the audiobook myself, which was a lot of fun. And yes, now out in bookstores anywhere. I think we're up to 10 languages as well. So if you live internationally, I say internationally, but there is no geographic center of gravity in the world. If you live in a non-Western English country, chances are it's in your preferred language if you have one that isn't English. So,
and yeah, thank you so much for us. ChrisBailey.com.
The website, ChrisBailey.com.
Excellent. And by the way,
calm.
By the way, calm. We already had, just as we wrap up, somebody who's been paying attention and listening to our conversation that's a member of Time Crafting Trust Premium has picked up a copy of the book. They just let us know in chat.
Thank you very much.
There you go. Chris, thanks so much for taking time to have a productive conversation with me today.
Thank you, Mike Barty.
It's always fun to talk to Chris, and I'm really excited about this book. It's How to Calm Your Mind. You can check it out. Just go to productivityist.com/podcast457 and you'll be able to find the link to purchase the book as well as other links we discussed. And the link, of course, to Time Crafting Trust Premium, which I mentioned off the top of the show. Another thing I mentioned off the top of the show is how you could easily find Marie's episode, which was last week, if you're a subscriber to the podcast. If you're not already a subscriber, now is the time to do it. Whether you're listening on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Overcast, wherever you are listening to podcasts, hit the subscribe button. That way you don't miss a single episode of what's to come. Next week, Alan Henry. Alan worked at Lifehacker while I was working at Lifehack. So it's going to be a great conversation. He's got a book out that I really enjoyed, and it's a fantastic conversation. You don't want to miss it. So subscribe to the podcast. That way you don't miss a single episode. Another way to help me and the podcast keep the lights on and keep things moving forward is to check out the sponsors that you heard on today's episode. So just go to productivityist.com/podcast sponsors to check them out. Explore them. And that way they know that we sent you. And that's it. That's the end of this episode. It's time for me to go and calm my mind a little bit and move forward the rest of my day. I'd like you to move forward with yours as well, hopefully with some productive activity, maybe some calming stuff as well. Until next time, I'm Mike Vardy, the host of A Productive Conversation, reminding you to stop doing productive and start being productive. See you later.